How have you lived without one of these? KC2WGB, K2LAW in the TechNet.
It's available, Dick, right now.
Good evening, Dick. No, I never did without. I've always had one. I have a 1502 and a 1503, which is my latest one. The 1503 was around 5,000. Right now, it has an LCD display, which I spoke to Glenn about. I have to replace it. It works very well, but the trace is running. It runs down. I would be more than happy to lend it to Alan if I get it repaired in the proper time for him to use it. But no, I've never done without one. I don't see how you can. Also, there is a way with a triggered scope and a pulse generator, you can make those measurements. You can not only measure the length of the line, but you can see any disturbance on the line.
Yeah, there are ways of making a poor man's TDR. It looks to me, Alan, like with a little bit of negotiating, looks like John got what you want. There's even a chance that Mel got what you want. Let me turn it over to Mel on this one. How inexpensive could a person get a hold of a TDR, or where would be the best place to borrow one? I think Alan only needs it for an hour at his QTH, and his buddy only needs it for an hour at that QTH. K2KEY, K2LIW.
This is K2KEY. Well, let me tell you, it is now a lot of this fancy, sophisticated instrument, like you say, that were in a kilobuck, are now very available. For instance, you can get a network analyzer. very reasonable. There's a company called Look Into It, Array, A-R-R-A-Y, Array Solutions. Take a look. You see what they offer, Dick. Amazing. That you take the instrument, they give you the software, you use it with your laptop, and boy, I'm telling you, you get kilobuck features on a small box. And this is not the old days. Today, you can do a heck of a lot by, of course, you know, it's based on mathematics called Fourier transport, and it's amazing what you can achieve today digitally, over.
That Array TDR, roughly how many dollars is that, Mel?
I don't know how my friend bought one. He bought that network analyzer, and I use it to check a filter made by Array Solutions, and I believe it goes, I remember what it went up to. I don't know, I don't remember the character. But Dick, actually I'm going to say honestly that my mouth fell open when I saw this instrument performing in such a way that I only thought you would see that, like you say, in a Tektronix instrument or Hewlett Packard that was in the thousands and thousands of dollars over.
Wesley recognized. Go ahead, Wesley.
When you have a chance, I have a question you could take a set on.
Okay. You're on the list, as you know. Alan, any final words? Because it looks to me like you've got a number of approaches to help that buddy of yours with the TS-2000 and HF-5B. Over to you, Alan.
I just want to say thank you to John for offering me to borrow that, and I may take you up on that, or at the very least just to see it work and learn how it works, and also find it interesting that I can kind of cobble one together with my scope and a pulse generator, and that makes an awful lot of sense. And I'd like to know how to do that as well. That would be a fun little project for a weekend. And well, I'm looking at the device you're talking about, and it looks like a small little handheld video game, or even like the size of a remote control. Is that the one you're talking about, Mel?
K2YO.
One of them, Alan. You look at Array Solutions. They have quite an ad in QSC. This month and in previous months. Look at, they have the Vector Network Analyzer, VNA, they have an Antenna Lab RF Analyzer, they have the Rig Expert Antenna Analyzer. Any one of them will most likely tell you exactly what you want. And like I say, I use the Vector Network Analyzer, the VNA 2160, 2180, and I was dumbfounded as to how this Godon thing works that so well, and it provides what we call S-sub-1-1 and S-sub-2-1 ports. Dual ports. I was amazed that Dick, it just, to see it work, if I blindfolded you and showed you the screen, you'd say, oh boy, this is one of the top-end Hewlett-Packard instruments, Dick, over.
I heard KC2MDP on the input, not coming through the machine because you don't have your PO oscillator turned on. Bernie just signed in, K2YO. Go ahead, Bernie. K2YO, didn't I hear you sign in? Maybe not. Steve, KC2MDP. If you've got your PO oscillator turned on, go right ahead. Okay. Paul, are you still with us? Could we, I know you had a brief report. WS2N, I hope we didn't put you to sleep with all this jazz. WS2N, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Dick, just one final quick question. It'll take 1 second.
Bill here. Go ahead, Dick.
Very fine, Paul. Glad you're still there. Go ahead, Alan.
You have mentioned in other TechNet that there's an antenna book that's old. I think it was a German author, but I'm not sure, a German named author, for antenna theory, basic antenna theory, that would help to teach from the, as a primer for Smith charts and how to read antenna characteristics. What was the name of the author in that book?
Whoa. Whenever I talk about German antennas, and Yagis in particular, I'm talking about Gunter Hack, DL6WU, DL Delta Lima 6 Whiskey Uniform. He's got a number of very good articles in the German magazine, and there's an English version of it. They're a little bit too deep for introductory. Introductory antenna information. The AR antenna book is an extremely good place to start. And there may have been another one I was suggesting at the time. I can't think of it right now. Mel, if you had somebody coming to you saying, I really want to know how antennas work and I want to start reading a book that's not going to make it too complicated, other than the ARRO antenna manual, what would you consider, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW?
You hit it right on the head. ARRL manual is the best way to go. In fact, if you want to know something, I'll tell you a laugh. I went into a very sophisticated engineer's office, and I know the book, you know, and he very, you know, he didn't want to admit that us ham, Navy, you know, are doing things that, oh, only us sophisticated engineers, hey, you got to belong to the IEEE, or you don't know nothing. I see the book, because I can see the side of it. And you know what he did with that book, Dick? Because of his great forwardness. Highly recommend that ARRL book to people that want to start at the beginning. He turns the book around to the back line of the book and facing into the shelf, over.
N2RSO, go ahead with your suggestion, sir. And start up with your name, please.
Okay, Dick, maybe I should let it drop. Hold on.
Very low audio, very low.
Okay, I hope this is better. A long time ago, when I was just beginning amateur radio, I found that the Practical Antenna Handbook, written by Joe Carr, very helpful. If it's still available, he might look into that one as well.
Okay, the Practical Antenna Handbook by Joe Carr. Your audio is about 10 dB lower than you would like it to be, Mr. RSO. Okay, that's another suggestion. Alrighty, let's go over to Paul. WS. Who is that? Okay, Paul, what we've heard in that NASA report on Tuesday is that in Mono Lake in California, which is an extremely salty lake, there's a whole bunch of bacteria growing there, and they're happy with their salt, and this researcher from NASA, NASA Astrobiology Department, discovered that not only can they tolerate an extremely salty solution, which would be toxic to almost any normal animal, she did some experiments and found out that you can substitute phosphorus, which is one of the basic elements of life, carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, and phosphorus are needed to make DNA. And she substituted arsenic, which is normally very toxic, but it's in a similar vertical column. It's on a similar vertical column on the periodic table. She substituted arsenic for the phosphorus, and this bacteria or microbe grew multiple generations using the arsenic. And so they discovered a new kind of life right here on Earth. In other words, when we're doing a search for extraterrestrial intelligence, we have to consider different kinds of life. But that's sort of what I got out of it. I wonder, depending on who you listen to, it either is very exciting or a little bit ho-hum. I think it's moderately exciting. I wonder what you think, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good, Dick. Yeah, it's WS2N. I watched it on the computer. I had the TV on. I watched it on NASA TV. And on CNN and Fox News, they lasted, well, one station lasted about 4 minutes, the other one went about 8 minutes. And that was pretty much it for that. I watched the whole thing on the NASA TV site on a computer. And it was interesting just to watch the attention span of the main news media. They started off the day before talking about, oh, NASA was going to have a news conference. And actually, everybody's hoping that they're going to find something on Mars or one of the moons around Saturn. I was hoping that as well. In fact, there was a report recently that they found oxygen on Enceladus. So to find oxygen on a planet like that, you know, free oxygen, is interesting. Is usually only one way to get that, and that's from some kind of a bacteria, some kind of an algae drop it. I was kind of hoping for that kind of a report. Of course, greater expectations. I was hoping for a Carl Sagan contact type of report. You know, that they received a signal from Lyra, you know, the constellation Lyra, like they had in the book or the movie. But unfortunately, it is interesting to chemists, anybody that's interested in biology, any scientific-minded person. But I don't think for the general public, unfortunately. The news is exactly what you said. They found that phosphorus was able to be replaced by arsenic. And now they know what to do, what they look for, life in, you know, in other locations. Instead of saying, well, we looked at this planet around this star, and it only has, different kinds of signs for life. We look for methane, and methane would be a good sign. Now we can look for other signatures. When we go back to Mars and drop it. On the Mars Curiosity rover that will be going up next year. It will be launched next year. Take, about 8 to 10 months to get to Mars. They'll be, they have equipment on board to diagnose the, whatever they're looking at. It's really the first mission since the Viking missions in 1976. That actually have equipment on board to search for microbial life or any kind of life that might be on Mars. Well, the equipment, they don't have to add any more equipment, but when they look at something and they say, okay, maybe this area has some kind of high level of arsenic in the area. We just like turn their cameras away and all their scientific equipment and drive off somewhere else. Well, maybe now they'll look at that. They'll say, look, we could possibly get different life forms on different moons and different planets that might not be what we're used to. That necessarily have to have phosphorus on board the biological piece of body that we're looking at. And interesting, the phosphorus only comes from a couple of places around Earth, and it's very limited. But every living structure has to have that. So we got it now. I mean, I learned quite a bit about biology that I didn't know. Let me drop it. And that's pretty much it, Dick. So, yeah, you pretty much nailed it. No, Wesley, I spoke to him during the week, and he had it down packed. So quite a few guys paid attention to that report. I have one more other quick report, Dick, not regarding this subject. Back to you.
I went to a website that was NASA connected, and I saw the news conference live, and I think the news conference itself went on for at least an hour and a half. And I was very disappointed that I couldn't find a website that recorded the original material from NASA itself. This was a report given from NASA headquarters in Washington, D.C., I think, or Maryland. I think it took place in Maryland, even though the experiment itself took place in California. I think it was a Maryland site of NASA. I think it was their headquarters where the actual news conference took place. Or maybe it was in Pasadena. We'll soon find out. Anyhow, I couldn't find a website that would allow me to play it back. I wanted to see it again. I know NASA Select eventually repeats things, but I wasn't able to find a schedule when I could find it, because there was a particular statement made at the end by the guy who acts as their moderator from NASA. He made a particular statement about science. I thought of Wesley immediately, and I wanted to. And I didn't record it. I didn't. I got too poor a memory. So I want to play that back again. Do you know of a place where I could go and listen to that whole news conference from beginning to end again? Over to you, Paul, K2LIW.
I've never tried that with the NASA. I watch a lot of NASA TV on a computer. It's unfortunate that it doesn't come through the cable vision system. Some of the systems do have it. Fios has it. In fact, when you go to the NASA TV site, they tell you right there that NASA is giving this NASA channel to any cable provider free of charge. No charge to them, no charge to the customers. If you want this, call up, in my case, Cablevision, and see if they'll do something about it. Well, we would need, you know, probably 100 times the amount of population of hams to call up to get that done. You would need a big boat. So to get that on the computer again, I guess you'd go back to, you could Google it maybe. I'm sure it's out there. Never done it. I'm going to get somebody else more computer savvy than me, Dick, on that. But my guess is you could Google it, and it'll probably come up maybe in a YouTube form or something. I got one other report about a flight coming up on the 7th. Dick, back to you.
I have a comment on
it. I did a whole lot of Googling and couldn't find it. Now, at first, I'm going to go back to what we'll go ahead, Alan.
Because I couldn't find it either. I was talking with Lou NY2H about it, and he didn't have all the details either. But now that Paul gave them, I have to say, I think this is pretty humdrum. And the reason is that phosphorus, with respect to its inclusion in DNA, really only acts as a building block. It's a backbone that's not really part of the active ingredients of DNA and what it does. Now, if you imagine a ladder, it's just the side struts of the ladder. It's not the rung. So the fact that that there's a life form out there that can substitute arsenic for the phosphorus is has some interest, but it's not really as interesting a story to me now that I hear it only discusses the substitution of phosphorus in DNA. If it had substituted the arsenic for the phosphorus in energy production as an ATP in the mitochondria, now you got something really super interesting, because that is the major component of life right there is ATP. That's the energy currency of the cell. But here, in DNA, the phosphorus is just a backbone. It really could be, I imagine, almost anything that could fit the basic characteristics. And because it's lower on the periodic table, it's going to take more energy to form all the bonds. It's going to be looser when it's put together. So I don't think this would bode well for life, because in different forms, because it would take so much energy to make it happen. It probably couldn't happen on its own. And if there was anything better, like our way of life using phosphorus, that's what's going to be used.
Comment, Dick.
Yeah, I'm going to go back to you in a minute, Paul. From my point of view, Alan, you do not have life as we know it, useful life with reproductive capability, without DNA. And although the AGTT, and your four kinds of ladder rungs on the DNA are not phosphorus, without the vertical sides to the ladder, you don't have DNA. And if you're on a planet that doesn't have phosphorus, but it does have arsenic, although it's a more difficult row to hoe, you still have the possibility of life. So to me, it's a little more than ho-hum. It's not a complete breakthrough, but her whole point was, if a planet was devoid of phosphorus, ordinarily there would be no life. If you've got arsenic, you still have the possibility. I thank you for a comment on that, Alan.
That sounds good to me, Dick. I agree with that. I just find that when I heard about the story, it seemed to be a really big deal to me. Just hearing how the phosphorus is being substituted with arsenic, it doesn't say to me that there's a whole new vista of life that could be open here. It'd be nice if it was. It's a nonlinear universe. You never know. But I just don't see it as a big deal. So now I understand why. I haven't been able to apply this story in any great detail. But, I mean, it's interesting. You never know.
There's one minor other thing that was significant about this set of experiments. And it does give a strong demonstration of the adaptability of life. She took a life form of these microbes living in this highly salty solution on Mono Lake. She taught them to live and adapt to arsenic instead of phosphorus, and to essentially abandon phosphorus. She's got multiple generations of this microbe living, breathing, and reproducing using arsenic, and in an environment where there was no phosphorus being supplied. And they did a bunch of fractional, what do they call it now, spectral graphic, what do you call that, gravity, mass spectrometry, and found out that it wasn't the microbes simply saving the phosphorus and carrying it over. They were living without the phosphorus. They had adapted to a life form with arsenic. That's a little bit more significant, showing the adaptability of this rather simple kind of life. Go ahead, Paul, WS2N, K2RIW.
Okay, this is WS2N. Yeah, I wonder what Alan thinks about this. They have one scientist on there, and he was saying he had brought metal chain with him, just a bunch of links, and used that as a demonstration showing that, well, this would be like holding the DNA together, this phosphorus that they normally have, very strong. Use arsenic, it's to do it instead of phosphorus, very weakly linked. The same kind of links, instead of a, like a metal link, like a steel link, you would have soft aluminum, and a couple of links like that. See, they would pull apart very easily at room temperature. So it's, but you know, they do hold together. The DNA is tricked into believing that, that it could use the arsenic instead of the phosphorus. Then he made the point, let me drop it. He made the point, you go to some of these different moons around planets in our solar system, of course, and in other solar systems, where the temperatures are so cold. You know, you go to the outer planets and, you know, you have minus 300 degrees Fahrenheit, which is, you know, commonplace. And at those temperatures, this arsenic molecules would be, the element arsenic would be, you know, in this DNA would be stronger. So, you know, it might be worth looking for, you know, when we're looking for things. So, you know, they brought that point up, and maybe that would be a factor, not necessarily in our environment, but maybe in another environment. They did show the DNA, and they showed these, like the dots at the end of the DNA helix, and they showed, well, here's the phosphorus, and they showed us, you know, graphically the phosphorus leaving and replacing it with the arsenic element. So, I mean, they did show that. But very good, and they want to rewrite, you know, one person says we're going to have to rewrite a couple of chapters in the book. Dick, I don't know if you saw that in the science books when they teach her, teach you about all this stuff. Back to you, Dick. WSWM.
In one of the articles that was linked to this whole announcement from NASA, said that they now realize that the Viking mission, when it looked for life on Mars, if it had found life of this form, the way that particular machine was configured, the machine was baking the life and looking for certain specific molecules to come back out of the baked material, and it was not looking for this molecule. So if there was life on Mars during the time that Viking was doing its thing, there's a slim chance that Viking was killing that small sample as opposed to detecting the life. There's a little bit more to the story, as you can tell. It's not a huge breakthrough, but I think it's a lot more than ho-hum, is my basic impression. I'm back to you for a final on this, Alan, then we're going to go over to Wesley. And to RFN, K2RIW, KC2RFN, K2RIW.
Hunch on, you know, this week.
Go ahead, Alan.
Actually, with what Paul just said, does have me changing my thinking a little bit, because the DNA relies on its ability to flex into different forms to do what it does. And because of that, the characteristics of the phosphorus molecules come into play, because just like a gooseneck, it can only flex within the size and shape of the rings that make up a gooseneck gland. Same thing here. But very interesting that because the arsenic molecule is a much bigger, puffier molecule, you're going to get different characteristics. Definitely going to have a weaker chain, but because of that, you'll have a more flexible chain, and that does open up a whole new avenue of possibilities right there that I'd never thought of. And I've always said for years that if there was life on other planets, it would have to be virtually identical to ours. Now I'm not so sure, because that is an interesting thought, that in a colder environment, maybe having the ability to flex and have a slightly different geometry, you might be able to get different forms of life that actually work and can be building blocks to more sophisticated forms of life. So very interesting. That actually does change my thinking considerably. So I hand that back to you at the K2RIW, KC2RFN.
EY comment.
Okay, go ahead, Mel.
On the Science Channel, they happened to show one time, I believe, that NASA sent up a rocket that captured some part of a comet. And on the comet, didn't they find that the comet was carrying some kind of basic forms of molecules that supposedly may be somewhere out there. In other words, they were sort of intimating that the comet actually may have brought life to the Earth. Over.
Yeah, I think it's called the Transpernia approach to propagating life. Lots and lots of organic molecules have been found in space, on comets, on asteroids, floating in space, and whatever. Radio telescopes have looked for the specific signatures. Lots of organic molecules are there. The basic building blocks of life are all over the place, waiting for the right conditions to fall on a planet, so to speak, and do their thing. That's one possible approach. So the Stanley Miller experiment, to me, strongly suggests that life as we know it is not necessarily unique. And the number of exoplanets we're discovering. I went to this beautiful lecture that was given at Stony Brook University last Friday night on the extremely high contrast astrophotography type things that they're now using. Do I have that particular piece of paper here? Yeah, it was called Extremely High Contrast Astronomical Imaging, done for comparative exoplanetology. Some really fancy instrumentation is being installed as we speak at Palomar and two other major telescopes, and they're now directly visualizing the planets going around a star from the Earth's surface. They're starting to do that, and I saw the graph of how much that hardware, let me drop this, how much that hardware is going to be increasing in capability over the next couple of years. So you're going to be hearing more and more. In fact, he announced, he, the guy doing the research, Mr. Mechev, M-E-T-C-H-E-V, he announced a brand new planet that he and his group has discovered that is just being put into a Science magazine as we speak. Another planet that they have visualized directly from the surface of the Earth while looking at another star. So you're going to hear a lot more of exoplanetology, a lot more planets are going to be discovered that have desirable characteristics, and it's just a matter of time before we find quite a bit more life is the strong indication. Paul, when it comes to this beautiful new thing that's being put up that you just mentioned called Curiosity, which I presume is the latest version similar to Spirit and Opportunity, I wonder if Steve Squires had anything to do with Curiosity, because, man, that was a successful project. He got, 4 years out of this thing that only had to last for 3 months, and lots of good measurements. WS2N, K2RIW, and SecNet.
Yeah, he was heavily involved with Spirit and Opportunity, but he's not the lead scientist for Curiosity. He was, he's involved, but I don't think he's as involved as he was with the previous one. Haven't seen any interviews yet with the top engineers that are involved with Curiosity. Except for one fella, an older fella, he went over to that department. He left the Mars rovers to go to Curiosity in the middle of the all the excitement. I'm trying to think of his name. He's the main guy. But I can't think of his name right now, Dick. We'll have to see if Steve Squires gets involved. I've seen him on interviews talking about Curiosity a couple of years ago, quite a few years ago. But I want to make a comment to Mel. If he looks up Stardust, let me drop it. Stardust spacecraft. I went up, about 10 years ago. So that was the one that went out to Comet. Comet Wild 2 is the way you would spell it. W-I-L-D, but it's really pronounced Built, like B-I-L-T. Built 2, but spelled Wild, W-I-L-D. And it had this aerogel-like tennis racket on board that scooped up all these chemicals, dust, and whatever from the tail of this comet, and brought it back to Earth a couple of years later. It separated from the main spacecraft, came down and protected our shell and shield, and that's the one that they found the building blocks, you know, amino acids, whatever they find in the biology world. It kind of confirms that a lot of theories that what Mel said, a lot of life forms could have come here from asteroids or comets, things of that nature. Stardust spacecraft, Mel. Yeah, one comment I want to make that this week, let me drop it. On the 7th, between 9 a.m. and 12:22, it's going to be the launch of a SpaceX spacecraft. It's a private company being funded through NASA. They've handed out like billions of dollars to the company to develop the next craft that will be able to bring cargo and eventually people back to the International Space Station. It'll be launched this on the 7th. So that would be Tuesday. And they have the 8th and the 9th as a backup in case they have weather problems or technical problems. It'll be launched from California, from Florida, from Cape Canaveral. And it's the first time they're going to have the rocket and the spacecraft both built by the same company. They had a launch of the rocket back in June, which was successful, and now they have the spacecraft being put onto the rocket. The first time they'll go in, you know, go up together, actually into orbit. Back in June, it was a suborbital flight. This thing's going to be orbital, maybe three or four orbits, and then it's going to come back on a parachute. So we'll see how that goes. Eventually, that will be bringing cargo to the International Space Station. Probably about 3 or 4 years down the road, and eventually people. So that's the way they're going to do things, you know, right now. It's a nice spacecraft that they built. The way it's planned is it'll bring the cargo up to the space station instead of just docking like the Russians do with the Progress mission. Mission failure.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
It looks like I timed out, but instead of taking the Progress spacecraft and burning it up over the Pacific, that's what the Russians do. What they're going to do with this is they're going to separate from the space station, and it will come back. It will be reusable. It will come back on parachutes. You know, they'll be able to reuse these things. And in fact, eventually, the booster rocket itself, it's a two-stage rocket called the Falcon, will also be reusable. So eventually, you'll be able to put up to 7 astronauts on board once that is developed. You're looking at probably 5-6 years down the road. So the launch of this thing, I'm sure this will make the news, will be on the 7th of on Tuesday between 9 and 12:22. They're back in that WS2M.
Thank you, Paul. Looks like some good stuff coming up. And some more great science going to take place on Mars. And other launch mechanisms. Looks like NASA's going a little bit more commercial off the shelf. Okay, Wesley?
Can you take a look before you go to Wesley?
Go ahead, John. You got it.
I think I was wondering maybe you could help me out on this. I have a 2 gigahertz generator puts out about 2 watts. What I'm looking to do is build 2 horns. I've heard of these coffee can horns. I could solder an end connector on the bottom of these cans. But one of my transmitter, one of my receiver, I want to use it for measuring distances about up to 500 feet. Is that practical, or am I wasting my time?
Oh, very practical. I've done that. First of all, I'm not quite sure now. Are you asking for the design of a horn? I could direct you to a website that will give you a basic design of a horn. And building that out of a galvanized sheet metal would be relatively easy. Putting a waveguide to coax adapter in the base of it with a type N connector, relatively easy. By the way, a 2 gig signal generator is fairly commonplace, but one that goes up to 2 watts of output, that's unusual. Kind of curious where you got that, what model number it is. Also, you say you want to measure range up to 500 feet. Are you saying you want to electronically confirm range in a radar-like manner? I've done that also, but up to you. Back to you, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, Dick, radar range type of work with it. Maybe a little further. That's an HP generator. It's an old one, very large, weighs about 130 pounds. It has plug-in modules. I have it. Different modules. It'll go to 2 gig, 7 gig. That's the generator I have. The exact model number, I don't remember.
Out of curiosity, you're using 2 gigs because you've got it, because as you go up in frequency, what you're trying to do becomes easier and smaller. Do you have any SIGGEN to go any higher? I'm trying to think now. When I did radar ranging at Wright Patterson, no, at Edwards Air Force Base, I was doing it at first with a simple feed horn. I wasn't going as far as 500 feet. Very simple instrumentation at first I was using. Nothing but a directional coupler between the transmitter and the receiver, and pulsing. And time domain pulsing, so to speak, is what I was using on a fairly fast scope. Kind of curious, you maybe don't want to tell me, but what do you want to do with this? Because there may be another way around it. Over to you, John.
No, Dick, I have no secrets, believe me. Just want to use it for ranging. If there's a different way I could do it, I would like to try. Now, when I get to 7 gigs, I don't have a 2-watt output on that unit. I think I only go to 1 watt at 7 gigs. And I would like to fabricate it out of the simple material, either copper or, like you said, maybe steel. Nothing fancy. Just want to get it to work, and then I'll take it from there.
You definitely want to Google W1GHZ, Whiskey 1 Golf Hotel Zulu, W1 gigahertz, is Paul Wade. He's got a very nice online book, free of charge, in which he shows you various ways of fabricating a horn. Googling W1 gigahertz is one way of finding it. I think it's W1GHZ.com. However, even if you can't find it that way, he's one of the alternate sites, one of the links that's on the Dr. Tom Williams site. Dr. Tom Williams is Whiskey Alpha 1 Mike Bravo Alpha.com. It might be .net, but I think it's .com. Whiskey Alpha 1 Mike Bravo Alpha. On that website, you'll see a bunch of links. The Paul Wade link, among many other links, are there, as well as a link on my RIW and how to tune Yagis to make perfect impedance match. But when you get to the W1 gigahertz online book, he's got a nice, easy-to-fabricate horn. There's ways of making the horn even higher in gain if you want to. The fact that you've only got 1 watt versus 2 watts when you're up to 7 gigs, I would favor the 7 gigs, because with the higher frequency, the gain of the antenna for a constant surface area of the throat, let me drop, I meant mouth. If you keep the mouth of the horn constant in area, which is really a fancy way of saying you're using the same number of square feet of sheet metal, the gain goes up 6 dB per octave. As you go up in frequency, double frequency, you get 6 dB more gain out of the exact same size horn. So higher frequencies, even though you lose a little bit of power, are going to gain you faster. And I recommend that, because you get all kinds of capability at the higher frequencies as far as developing directivity in small, easy-to-handle packages. What I was doing was using a pulsing network on the signal generator, and I think I was pulsing the signal generator itself. No, I was using a pin diode Hewlett-Packard switching assembly beyond the signal generator to do the pulsing. And I think, you get the greatest amount of isolation between transmit and receive if you build two separate horns side by side. You get a zillion dB of isolation between the two. Let me drop. And the horns get nice and small when you go to a frequency like 7 gigs. So two horns side by side, one for transmitting and one for receiving. One's connected continuously to a spectrum analyzer as an RF front end, and then somewhere in the IF strip of the spectrum analyzer where the bandwidth is still nice and wide, you put a crystal detector, and you've got some stages of gain. That into the right kind of an oscilloscope is a beautiful radar system with proper syncing between that oscilloscope describing the displaying the pulse coming back from the crystal detector versus the timing of the pulse that went out. So I did that and used that thing temporarily inside of the world's largest anechoic chamber at Edwards Air Force Base. KC2WGV, K2RIW in the FedNet.
Okay, Dick, I've got that website. I will look that up. I will look that up, and maybe I can construct something useful. And I was wondering, if I were to use an end connector in the rear, I would just have to put a copper loop antenna or something right on the connector. I wouldn't have to make any type of transition other than that, would I?
It's even simpler than that, John. You need nothing but a monopole. In other words, from the center pin of the type end connector inside of the waveguide, you would start off with a probe that's a quarter wavelength long, a piece of wire that's a quarter wavelength long, approximately a quarter wave from the short circuit of the waveguide, the short circuit end. Those are just starting positions. The full impedance match is going to be shorter than a quarter wavelength, and the distance to the shorter end is going to be a little bit different than a quarter wavelength. But that'll get you off and running. His design will also get you off and running. A simple monopole. Would you believe that a waveguide to coax adapter really is nothing but the microwave equivalent of a vertical ground plane antenna? That's what launches the signal in that waveguide. I wonder if you've ever heard that before, John. Over to you, K2RIW.
I haven't heard it before, Dick, but it does make a lot of sense. And that's what I will do. I'll probably be able to pick up something on eBay, maybe similar to that band. I don't know. It's not a very popular frequency from what I remember. Also, I bought a 3561A. I will have it in approximately 10 days. I just wanted to fill you in on that. So if you ever need to borrow it, give me a call.
Oh, boy. Somebody finally got one. Was it on eBay? And what condition is it in? I did take a quick look right after our last conversation on eBay, and somebody was selling one in non-working order. And boy, I was tempted. Over to you, John.
Yes, Dick, and I believe he wanted $350 for that. I didn't buy that. I saw another one for $900, which looked pretty good. The face was pristine, but when I spoke to him, he was a little flaky. So I went for approximately a little over $1,000, and I got the service manual, the operation manual, and the instrument in A1 working condition and traceable.
You're going to like that machine. It's the 3561A. It has a built-in tracking signal generator. So therefore, you can sweep across frequencies and measure the response down to millihertz, or up to 100 KC if you like, and it also will give you a waterfall display. When you look at weak signals buried in the noise displayed on that machine in a waterfall display, my goodness, can you find the bug under the rug, if you know what I mean? Once you make that machine sing, you're going to say, well, how have I lived without one? A little bit on the pricey side, and I think it's roughly 1990 vintage, 20 years old, but HP made one way ahead of their time on that one. Back to you, John.
Yeah, I just hope I can learn to work it. it looks really nice, and it has a lot of features, and it can be used as a time domain or frequency domain. It has two features, which I thought was very nice. I didn't know that until I started reading it.
There's a slim chance that that machine can be used in the time domain as a time domain reflectometer, or with a minor variation with a built-in and a little auxiliary gadget. I think you can make a time domain reflectometer out of that. I believe it's got either 16 or 18 bits of analog to digital, and even though they call it one channel, I think it's got a two-channel mode. I think you can measure input and output simultaneously and do a transfer curve as a function of frequency of your device under test. because of its built-in signal generator. That thing has got a lot of capability. And as I said, when they updated it to the one that they called two-channel, they lost an awful lot of the user-friendliness. It's got a bit of a learning curve, but just like the Hewlett-Packard 8566 spectrum analyzer, which is the best analog-type spectrum analyzer mankind has ever created. The company I worked for at one time owned 50 of those at $70,000 a piece. Can you imagine? And by some means, I never got my hands on one of those. My son and I were both using them at the company, and we really fell in love with them. But that 3561, even if the one you've got is broken, the most expensive single part in there is probably the cathode ray tube, and that's a replaceable item, or the power transformer, that's a replaceable item. For a guy like you with your enthusiasm, even if the power transformer had a complete short circuit, I know what you would do. You would simply rewind it. And it would be a lot better off, if you know what I mean. So I think you're going to like that. I hope that all works out well. Back to you for any final on that one, John.
Yeah, I'm hoping to have a lot of fun with that machine. I do own a spectrum analyzer that first one you mentioned that you worked with your son. I paid $26,000 for that. I bought it used, but it is in perfect condition. It works really well. Great machine. I love it. But, okay, I know Wesley has a few things, so thank you for answering my question. And hello, Mel, by the way. And I'll talk to you guys soon.
Wow, were you equipped. You own an 8566. I've never known a normal human being with one of those. Wow, you must have one hell of a lab. N2XJN, K2RIW. Go ahead, Wesley.
Thank you very much. Well, I look forward for John to have this, as we both join the forces to try to educate ourselves. Now, my question. Gravitational pull of air is holding the air. At the same time, air is being charged. So the charged particles create electromagnetic field. The electromagnetic field is in constant interaction with the magnetic field of the air, which might cause the change of the weather. Let me jump.
Yeah, I think that that's a minor effect, though. I'm going to interrupt you on that one, Wesley. There's a continuous flow of current through this extremely high resistive material called air. There's a continuous flow of current from the ionosphere down to the Earth. But that is a uniform current flow all over the Earth, and the magnetic field that that phenomena creates could be orders of magnitude smaller than the magnetic field created by the core of the Earth. That's my first guess on that one, but it's a pure guess. Over to you, Wesley.
Yeah. One of the evidence of the electrically charged particles is natural light in polar regions, caused by the collision of charged particles directed to the Earth magnetic field. Directed by the Earth, I'm sorry, magnetic field. And aurora is usually observed at night and typically occurs in ionosphere. Okay, now, I came further to the conclusion also that we have a capacitor that has a potential of 36,000 volts between the Earth and ionosphere, then Tesla, in order to tap this energy, had to accomplish two things: make a cold sink in the ambient energy and devise a way of making the sink self-pumping. Such sink would have to be at a lower energy state than surrounding medium, and the energy to continue flow into it, the sink would have to maintain the lower energy state while meeting the power requirements of the load attached to it. Electrical energy, well, that would be watt seconds, is product of volts times amps times seconds, because the period of the oscillation does not change if the voltage or current has to be variable in the coil energy equation.
I'm trying to get to the point in which we're not talking about the current that is the DC current, but it's the AC, which has a factor of frequency. So, when I was talking about the movement, constant movement of the contents of the Earth, I stated that inner core speed faster, core less, mental less, and then we have a steady structure on the crust. So my understanding is that because we have a friction of these layers within the Earth, the friction is actually the energy. The energy has to manifest itself somehow. That would be by the impact on the gravitational field, magnetic field, and electrical charge. So at that point, what Tesla and followers of the Tesla thought is that we're talking about a certain frequency that we have to tune into. At the same time as Glenn made his discovery, that he discovered the voltage and he was able to use the dials and the LEDs to create light from the wire of the antenna that was a certain distance to the Earth. My question then is, if Glenn was to use a resonance circuit to find what would be the best frequency of gathering that voltage instead of simply rectifying that voltage, he might be able to find that the amount of energy that he is able to extract is much bigger. Do you follow what I'm talking to? What I'm driving to, Dick?
I think I'm understanding some of it. I'm going to make some comments on the portions that I understand. I personally experience current flowing from my dipole antenna into my hand when at 16 years of age I had my bare feet on the floor of a concrete floor of the basement of a building, the house where I was living, and I touched that antenna. And I felt the tingle of the DC current flowing down that transmission line. The voltage picked up by an antenna, like a NFED ZEP antenna, for instance, is DC. Even though the antenna, under normal circumstances, operates with an RF energy flowing into it, that current that you pick up because of either electrostatic creation mechanism because of the wind blowing by the antenna, or because of the static field between the ionosphere at roughly 350 kilovolts compared to the Earth, and the air being a very mildly conducting medium in between. What that mechanism is, I'm not quite sure. I know that the magnitude of the voltage that you pick up is a DC voltage. It changes somewhat from day to day and maybe from hour to hour. It's an extremely small amount of power. It'll light up in any two neon bulbs, but could you build a big enough grid of these antennas to extract enough of that energy out of the air? Interesting question. I wonder if anyone's ever pursued that. Since I was only getting milliwatts, it would suggest that you need acres and acres of antennas to get something like a watt. It sounds like a tough way to go. Let me drop it. I got another comment. Comment, Dick. I heard somebody with an extremely weak signal, but I didn't hear anything specific out of it. I could tell there was a signal there. The rotation of the core of the Earth compared to the crust. At first you would say, gee, there's a whole lot of friction between the two, and that it's going to be generating a voltage, generating magnetic field. It does generate a magnetic field, without a doubt. And the rotation, I think, is being caused by a convection effect, but I'm not sure. But I'm not convinced that there's any electrostatic voltage being created by the core of the Earth rotating. Now, the fact that the core is rotating and it's making a magnetic field, if that magnetic field was sweeping across the Earth, yes, that would be generating a voltage, Lenz's law or Faraday's law. But that field really is extremely steady state. It does change from day to day. The aurora borealis is one of the mechanisms by which it gets changed. The aurora is primarily, I think, due to particles coming from the sun. The solar wind